Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. It's a potpourri of stories that I think you will find of interest. Stories that we're retrieving from the cutting room floor. I do a 2-hour radio program on weekends, and it's crammed with stories, and it's crammed with phone calls and answers, but time is short, and we got a lot more to share with you. So here we go via the vehicle of podcasts. So this is an interesting story about the gut-brain relationship. You know, we talk a lot about the relationship between the brain and the gastrointestinal tract. People who are under stress experience more IBS. Sometimes stomach acid production is increased, and people develop ulcers under stressful conditions. This is a well-known phenomenon, a stress ulcer. But it's a two-way street because the gut affects the brain. And specifically, the composition of the gut, the microbiome, has a major impact on the brain. We know, for example, that there are mood effects of the microbiome on the brain, that individuals who suffer from depression or anxiety, that there actually may be signals from the gastrointestinal tract to the brain that impact mood. Also, certainly there's implications for appetite, because the composition of your gut may affect the hypothalamus and other areas that determine appetite and craving. And so the microbiome impacts the brain in that regard. Here's another very interesting angle on that. And this is, I got to say, this is more of theoretical import. It's not like, here's a supplement, you know, take this pill and we're going to alleviate all your problems. But it's news that you can use, because what you eat affects the composition of your microbiome. And if you eat a lot of chemicalized junk with a lot of sugar and poor quality fats and not a lot of healthy nutrients and very little in the way of healthy fiber or beneficial polyphenols, or if you gunk up your intestinal tract with artificial sweeteners, which are known to damage the gastrointestinal tract, or if you use emulsifiers. Emulsifiers are ubiquitous in processed foods. These will change your microbiome for the worse. Okay, where am I going with this? Headline: gut bacteria boost risk after stroke. So very interesting is that, so this is once you have a stroke, the composition of the bacteria in your gut influence your subsequent recovery. So the take-home message is, it behooves you, if you've had a stroke, to do the right things, to take probiotics, to eat a healthy diet, to replenish the flora in your gastrointestinal tract. These are mouse experiments. A series of new experiments reveals a surprising back and forth between the brain and the gut in the aftermath of a stroke. First of all, when a mouse is given an experimentally induced stroke, the bacteria in their gastrointestinal tract changes in an unhealthy way. And so what they found is that when they transferred bacteria from the guts of healthy mice to the intestinal tracts of mice who'd had a stroke, there was a more rapid recovery than if they did not receive a fecal transfer. Yeah, that sounds kind of yucky, but it has very interesting implications for the future of stroke treatment. But when the mice who'd gotten strokes got bacteria from the intestinal tracts of other mice who'd had strokes, it spurred a fourfold increase in immune cells known to exacerbate inflammation in the brain. So You know, this, like I said, this is this news you can use? I mean, should you be taking healthy mouse poop after you have a stroke? You know, probably not. Has this been explored yet in humans? Because, you know, we've cured countless diseases in mice, but sometimes it just doesn't transfer to people. But they actually say in this article, the research published in the Journal of Neuroscience hints that poop pills laden with healthy microbes could one day be part of post-stroke therapy. So, something, you know, I've noticed is in some of our patients, at the Hoffman Center, and, you know, we have many patients with very, you know, serious conditions. Some of them are elderly. And we've had a couple of patients who've had strokes, unfortunately. And I just feel devastated when I, you know, pick up the phone and a patient informs me that they've had a stroke. But what's interesting, uniformly among the patients that, I've seen, and some of them, the strokes may have occurred because, they may have been, reluctant to take certain medications that prevent strokes, blood thinning medications and so on, may, in some cases against my medical advice. But, nonetheless, the patients who've had strokes have recovered almost 100%, you know, relatively rapidly, without, profound damage or, irreversible deficits in their ability to walk, talk, you know, grasp or write. They have recovered quickly. And another reason that it possibly diet has had an effect, possibly probiotics have had an effect. But another thing that could have impacted their recovery is that many of them are taking fish oil, which is really beneficial for stroke recovery. So, and perhaps some of the other vitamins, some of the other nutritional support that we've given them. So, the gut has an impact on brain inflammation. And we're going to see this in other, you know, conditions that involve brain inflammation. Post-stroke. Okay. That's one. Post-concussion or, you know, someone who's had a head injury. That's another. Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and perhaps other neurological disorders. The gut is very important and is assuming a more and more central role in understanding virtually all disorders that we encounter in medicine. Okay, this item is near and dear to me because I'm a triathlete. And as a triathlete, you know, I read a lot about triathlons. And one of the most dismaying things about triathlons is that in the course of doing triathlons, people die. People die during triathlons. And some of them are healthy, relatively healthy young individuals. And sometimes there's, you know, an older person who's kind of pushing the limits. And recently, just before the triathlon that I did, this year, you know, we're standing there, it's like, you know, 6:30 in the morning. The sun's just coming up and, they play the Star Spangled Banner. And then they also had a moment of silence for a triathlete who had died the week before at a triathlon at another location. And, in this specific case, it was a 67-year-old man who died during the swim. And when I look at, you know, these rare cases where people die during triathlons, and it's a handful of people, every year who die, it strikes me as interesting that it usually happens during the swim portion of the triathlon. There, for those not familiar with the triathlon, it's a swim, bike, run. So in the case of the one I did, it's about just shy of a mile swim, 0.9-mile swim, followed by a 25-mile bike ride, followed by a 6-mile run. And so you would think that most logically, the time when people would be most likely to die would be sort of towards the end, right? Because, you know, you've been exercising in some cases for, you know, certainly 2+ hours, because the best Olympic times are just shy of 2 hours in Olympic competition, as we saw in Rio. And the average mortal does it in, you know, just short of 3 hours, a little more than 3 hours. My best triathlon time was just around 3 hours, which is slow, but hey, I got it done. You would think that the most vulnerable time would be after you've been exercising for, say, 2.5 hours, or during the run, which often is the hottest part of the day. Sometimes, you know, these are summer events. It's in sweltering heat. You know, you get dehydrated and boom, you're gone. You get a cardiac arrhythmia, or, you know, just you drop dead. But actually it occurs most often during the swim. And there's several reasons for that. Is the swim is a little chaotic. You know, they have mass starts where sometimes literally hundreds of athletes jump in the water. And I have likened it to swimming with a pack of piranhas. You know, you're swimming and, you know, you're in the middle of the pack and you're catching up to people, and then they kick you in the face. Sometimes they dislodge your, you know, your goggles. You have to remain oriented. You know, the water is cold. You're wearing a tight wetsuit, which, you know, constricts your breathing. Some people aren't used to swimming in the open water. They swim in pools, which is relatively sedate. And then the water's choppy. It's cold. There's a lot of other participants. People are swimming over you, you know, because they're faster than you. And, you know, it just creates almost like a panicky kind of thing. There's an article here, that tells us why most people, die during triathlons. And it's something called immersion pulmonary edema. And it's a medical phenomenon, whereby literally the lungs suddenly fill with body fluids. And, there are several reasons why this occurs. One is that people sometimes overhydrate prior to these events. So their body is overloaded with fluid. They do it because they're worried that they won't be hydrated enough, but they hydrate, hydrate, hydrate. That's what they say. And then you put on a constricting, very tight, neoprene wetsuit. And, that really constricts your chest. It actually presses on your chest. And then you jump into very cold water. In some cases, I mean, the event that I did, you know, we didn't wear wetsuits because it was wetsuit optional. Nobody wanted to wear a wetsuit because it was too warm. The water was like, you know, 80 degrees. So no need for a wetsuit. But often cold bodies of water use wetsuits. So immersion pulmonary edema, also abbreviated IPE, occurs when the lungs suddenly fill with body fluids during activities in cold water, such as swimming and diving. It can lead to difficulty breathing, wheezing, and confusion. Because when you start feeling that sensation, you know, you're trying to swim for time, and all of a sudden you're afflicted with this, and then, you know, you get a little panicky, and you can have a heart arrhythmia and die. It can be serious and even fatal. And it can occur in healthy individuals. But it sometimes is more likely to occur in people with left ventricular hypertrophy, a condition where the heart muscle becomes thickened. And that's a characteristic of people who have high blood pressure. And so therefore, I think it actually might be warranted for people who are embarking on this and not used to this, to get an echocardiogram to make sure that they don't have this before, you know, they get a little ahead of themselves and try and compete in these kinds of events. Now, the interesting sidelight to this is, what they're saying here is, 16 triathletes who died from unclear causes had higher measures of heart wall thickness. And so that's a possible contributing factor to this IPE. But here's a very interesting potential antidote. I don't know if anybody's tried this. Study suggests sildenafil may relieve severe forms of edema in swimmers. Sildenafil is also known as Viagra. Swimmers and divers who are prone to a sudden and potentially life-threatening form of pulmonary edema in cold water could benefit from a simple and readily available dose of sildenafil. You know, they're saying, if you are prone to this condition, or if you're at risk of this condition, just take a Viagra before the race. Triathlete Calder Becker, 51, was diagnosed with swim-induced pulmonary edema and she therefore enrolled in studies at Duke University in 2011. Afterward, she consulted her cardiologist and was prescribed, this is a she was prescribed a low dose of sildenafil that she takes shortly before her competitions. Quote, I have successfully raced in 20 triathlons since I started taking sildenafil, including 5 ultra events that required 10-kilometer swims. Translation, what is that like? That's like a 4-mile swim. Oh, no, that's more like, I'm sorry, that's like, let me do the translation. It's like a 6-mile swim. 10K, no, that's exact. That's 6.2-mile swim. That's a 6.2-mile swim, which is no mean feat. I have not had an incident since then, says Calder Becker. I didn't want to give up racing. This is something my husband and I do together. You know, Viagra has kept them together. And we traveled together to competition, so it has meant everything to me to continue. So, yeah, I guess in females, it's quite innocuous. You know, I hope that in males, it doesn't produce the familiar benefits that might occur in the bedroom. I think you're probably kind of distracted by the athletic competition to experience those. And besides, those wetsuits are awfully tight anyway, so that probably would conceal any potential embarrassment that might threaten the race of a male contestant. But interesting, you know, why Viagra? Well, Viagra actually is a nitrate. It actually works a little like nitroglycerin, and therefore it may enhance circulation, not just in that certain part of your body, but also in your lungs, which may help to reduce the risk for pulmonary edema. Patients with what's called pulmonary hypertension sometimes take these types of medications. Cervical dysplasia is a condition that is quite common in women. It is basically an abnormal pap smear, which puts women at risk for cervical cancer. So when you get a pap smear, they grade it, 1, 2, 3, 4. And the CIN score, which is stands for cervical intraepithelial neoplasia, is graded 1 through 4. It's actually pretty common. The likelihood of progression to cervical cancer, if it doesn't spontaneously regress, sometimes these things spontaneously get better. But if it doesn't get better and it's not treated, and it can be treated with various types of excision or topical treatments, then the likelihood of progression to cervical cancer is anywhere from 30 to 50%. So it's a harbinger of risk for a potentially very serious life-threatening disease. This is actually what all this hullabaloo is about with the HPV vaccine. The vaccine that's supposed to be given to adolescent girls and boys, or even pre-adolescent girls and boys. So they want to prevent cervical cancer. So the risk factors, of course, are the HPV virus. Smoking is a risk factor for cervical cancer. And so they report here in an article by Tori Hudson, who specializes in women's problems. She's a naturopathic physician, really excellent researcher, one of a new breed of really science-based naturopathic physicians who study the relationship between natural therapies and treatment of medical disorders in a very systematic scientific way. She reports on a new study, interestingly, out of the country of Iran, which is actually it's a real bastion of nutritional research. For some reason, you know, despite the oppressive regime there, you know, it's a country of really well-educated people where they've, you know, done good science. They have medical universities, and apparently nutrition is a big topic for research there. They took 58 Iranian women aged 18 to 53 with biopsy-proven CIN1, which is the first step in an abnormal pap smear. The women were randomized to take either a placebo or 200 micrograms of selenium per day for 6 months. That's a pretty standard dose of selenium, 200 micrograms. What they found was that after 6 months, a greater percentage of those in the selenium group had regression to their CIN1 compared with the placebo group. 88%, which is, that's pretty darn good. 9 out of 10 of them, virtually, had a regression to normal compared to the placebo group. Now, there is a certain percentage of spontaneous regression. Don't just stand there, do nothing. Usually, you know, around 60% of women regress spontaneously. So in this study, that was true to form. 56% of the placebo women regressed, but with the selenium, they raised it to 88%. And in addition, they measured some other things in the selenium group. They found improvements in the metabolic profile, decreases in fasting glucose and insulin, improved insulin resistance, increased total antioxidant capacity, increased HDL levels, and decreased triglyceride levels. So selenium is a very important nutrient. It may have antiviral effects. It may have immune-enhancing effects. It's a companion to glutathione, which is a wonderful free radical quencher. And therefore, you know, we would include selenium in our armamentarium of nutrients for cervical dysplasia. I'm very partial to EGCG from green tea for cervical dysplasia taken internally. There's actually a topical medicine for HPV that is, I believe it is the first dermatological herbal medicine that has been approved by the FDA. In a recent study, EGCG has been found to reduce the viral activity of the human papillomavirus. The EGCG extract both killed the cancer cell growth and helped stop the HPV virus. Recently, an ointment called Verigen, V-E-R-E-G-E-N, was approved for the treatment of external genital and perianal warts due to HPV. That's sometimes referred to as condyloma acuminata. And while it's not recommended for internal use for women with abnormal pap smears, it's interesting because what is Verigen? Well, Verigen is the first botanical drug approved for prescription use in the United States. It is 15% sine catechins. That sounds very similar to epigallocatechin gallate. It's an ointment. In clinical studies, it was proven to provide complete clearance of external genital and perianal warts in most patients. 56% got a very positive response versus 35% for placebo, and it offers a high rate of sustained clearance, 93% for patients who achieve complete clearance. That is promising. And I think EGCG is part of our program for cervical dysplasia for sure. We might also include DIM, dienyl methane. There's some studies that suggest that higher doses of folate may prevent the transformation of precancers to cancer. There's some concern if you have active invasive cancer, whether the folate might switch roles and become a cancer promoter. That's a caution. I'm not a big fan of high-dose B-complex vitamins, in particular folate. If you have a solid tumor or an invasive tumor or metastatic cancer, but certainly in preventing precancerous lesions like Barrett's esophagus, another example of a squamous cell precancerous lesion. It's a form of metaplasia or dysplasia, preventing it from going cancerous. Same thing with cervical cancer. There may be a role that other antioxidants play. carotenoids, vitamin C, perhaps zinc, even vitamin D may be a regulator of cell growth. So there you have it in terms of CIN protocols, and there are perhaps even a couple of other things that might reasonably be included, like curcumin, pomegranate, boswellin, sulforaphane from the cruciferous vegetable family, something like AHCC, something that enhances the natural killer cell activity. All these may play a role for women who are desirous of preventing a progression towards cervical cancer, which might necessitate a hysterectomy. So there you have it for this month's potpourri of health and nutrition stories. I hope you find them useful and have enjoyed them. I enjoyed sharing them with you. Thanks for being with us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.